So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review, man.
Let's do another one.
God, no, I don't know.
Come on, man. Let's do something that really cooks.
Something that cooks.
All right.
All right. All right, this is an oldie, but, well, it's an oldie where I come from. All right, guys, listen, this is a blues riff from B. Watch me for the changes and try and keep up, okay?
Ole, 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 ole. Ole, ole. Ole, 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 ole. Ole, ole.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Review Away. It's John Pollock and Wei Ting with you. And Wei, it's not every time that we have a guest on, much less someone who's going to hop aboard the Review Away train for the entire duration today, but it's a pleasure to have Todd Martin, who many people will be aware of, not only to our wrestling fans at the WrestlingObserver.com website, but also to our MMA fans out there from SureDog.com. Todd, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks. Did I hear faint applause in the background? I feel like such a warm greeting.
That was Wei. He was actually standing here giving you a standing ovation.
Yeah.
That's so nice. Thank you, Wei.
No problem.
Now, Todd, this was your suggestion a couple of weeks ago that, you know, this podcast, we've been doing this for about, I would say almost four and a half years at this point. Never have we done a pro wrestling guerrilla review, and this is a promotion near and dear to your heart that you you brought this particular show that we're going to chat about to our attention as a must review.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of yes and no in the sense that, yeah, I brought it to your attention, but it's also just a case of I heard you mentioning a few times yourselves over the years that you were interested in doing PWG at some point, just sort of in passing. And I thought, you know, I should sort of give them a little pat on the butt, so to speak, and sort of encourage them to get on it. So I suggest, why don't we do one? And then maybe that'll encourage you to start doing some more on your own.
Yeah. Well, go ahead, Wei.
I mean, over here up in Toronto, you know, as far as I know, they've never run shows around here. And, you know, you hear all the time about Ring of Honor. You hear a lot about... just even like a Dragon Gate, but right underneath that, you always hear Pro Wrestling Guerrilla, but we've never just had a chance to see it. So can you just tell us about, you know, the formation of the company and a little bit about its origins?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's sort of funny in that it was just sort of fortuitous in my part that I even stumbled upon it, in that I moved out to L.A. In 2004 for school. And at that point, I was just looking for some live wrestling, and I knew that PWG was a promotion that was running shows with a bunch of ROH guys, some TNA guys. And so I'd go because it was live wrestling, and you had a lot of star power. But at that point, it was still in the formation years where PWG really hadn't developed that much of an identity of its own. Certainly not one that was nationally known. But over time, it sort of grew in popularity amongst fans and also amongst workers. It's one of the more popular places for wrestlers to go because they have a lot of freedom, a lot of reasons we'll talk about as we're going on throughout this show. And the show we're reviewing today, I had suggested a few shows for John to choose from. And my thought in choosing the show wasn't so much that this was sort of an extraordinary show from a standpoint of matches by any means, but I thought that there was a number of interesting things on the show, and it was also during sort of a formative period for the promotion. The promotion now is sort of settled into what it is. It runs regularly in Reseda. It's sort of got its building. It's got its fans. PWG sort of has an identity as to what it was. The show we're reviewing was earlier in the promotion's days. It was in a period when there was still Still establishing itself, still sort of trying to find what its identity was going to be. And I think that makes it sort of a good jumping off point for discussion. So we can sort of go into how the promotion came to be and then sort of provide, you know, sort of an opening for some of the later days of the promotion.
Well, and when Todd gave me some suggestions, I mean, how could I pass on a show entitled Enchantment Under the Sea? I think I was immediately swayed by the title here. Now, before we go into the show, Todd, having gone to so many of these shows in the past, can you tell us a bit about the crowd? Maybe what kind of makes them so unique? Because as you say, a lot of the talent, they speak so glowingly about these shows, which, you know, it's typically about 300 or so that meet in Reseda for these shows. And the crowd is always considered a very big part of these shows.
Yeah, I mean, that was also sort of an evolution process. The show that we're viewing is a little bit before it sort of became that identity, where the crowd became very supportive, very open to different things. And the crowd at this point was still sort of, you could see the earlier vestiges of that, and that it's a crowd that enjoys pro wrestling, is very knowledgeable about pro wrestling, but doesn't have the same cynicism as the East Coast crowds. And I mean, I sort of myself, honestly, sort of more identify with sort of the East Coast cynicism, and that's where I was more often growing up. So I was used to sort of that ECW, ROH, sort of more critical of the stuff that wasn't as good. But the PWG crowd was very, and has always been very open to all sorts of different wrestlers, all sorts of different styles. It's not a crowd that's apt to be particularly harsh on things that aren't working very well. And if, you know, if something goes wrong, they'll be supportive of it, and they'll give new people a try. It's very much a receptive crowd.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think East Coast crowds are like you say, more cynical?
I think a lot of it is sort of the long-term Philly, New York sort of attitude towards sports. Because at that point in wrestling was, you know, for a very long period of time, drawing sports crowds. And you went to a crowd, particularly New York and Philly, but also D.C., Pittsburgh, a lot of sort of the Boston actually fits in perfectly with Philly and New York. These were crowds that were very tough places for opposing teams to play. You know, if you went in there to, you know, to watch the Flyers play or the Eagles play in Philly, you didn't want to be supporting the other team. I mean, these were some hardcore fans. And that sort of attitude towards sports is taking it very seriously and, you know, being very harsh on things that they don't, on the opposing team, I think sort of carried over into pro wrestling when they perceived that you weren't on their team, you weren't a part of them. Whereas LA, you know, I mean, it's sort of a stereotype, but it, you know, the West Coast is generally more laid back. It is a place that isn't as, you know, it's not full of people that are sort of as confrontational, I think, in general, and particularly in the context of sports. So I think there's just sort of a different attitude towards that, along with just sort of, I think, also an evolution in wrestling fans in general. I think wrestling fans over time have become, I think there's sort of been a change, and that wrestling fans are more, sports entertainment has taken over more, where it's more about sort of a show and having a good time and having fun, as opposed to sort of really getting into rooting for one person over the other. And the more you sort of have that lighter edge, I think the less likely it is for people to get really worked up over a heel or to get really worked up over an angle that they don't like.
Now, Todd, I know a lot of people that might be listening to this show, perhaps even for the first time coming over, they listen to you with Brian Alvarez every week, and I know that they want to know the answer to this question, and that is, if Pro Wrestling Guerrilla were able to raise up the funds and bring CM Punk in, do you think PWG would advertise him ahead of time?
See, see, this is why I enjoy Way so much more on these shows than you, John. You frame that question so in such an unfriendly manner. How dare you? The whether to advertise or not. But I will say this: if CM Punk did show unadvertised on a PWG show, I think it would in fact generate a lot of buzz.
And then you can build up to the big match down the road and cash in. Well, let's get in here to Pro Wrestling Guerrilla, Enchantment Under the Sea, and...
Where does this name come from, first of all?
Enchantment Under the Sea? Mm-hmm. Have you never seen Back to the Future?
Remind me.
This was the big dance.
where McFly meets his mother at the Enchantment Under the Sea dance.
And what are PWG shows typically named after? Is it 80s references like that?
Very much along those lines. I mean, it's a lot of sort of pop culture references, puns, comedy names. Over time, some of the bigger shows, they sort of will sometimes go more more straightforward. But, you know, like they had the Wrestle Reunion shows, and they called it Kurt Russell Reunion. I remember there was a Steen Wolf show.
Yes.
Obviously, a takeoff of another 80s movie there. I frankly, some of the references I don't get. But a lot of them are familiar to sort of fans of obscure movies or even not so obscure movies or bands.
Now, this show took place May the 20th of 2006. For those of you out there, the night before the greatest Great Khali match in history, where he took on The Undertaker at a WWE pay-per-view. So there you go, everyone. Get into your historical placement. So we kicked the show off. Should be noted on this DVD, Todd, no commentary. Were you a fan of this or not?
Well, typically, in the past, all of the other PWG shows that I've watched, I've always done it through DVD. And on DVD, you have the option of turning on the alternative commentary. So you can listen to what's typically sort of a comedy-oriented style with a bunch of different people. Kevin Steen does it sometimes, Disco Machine, and Excalibur did it for a long time. Excalibur, you know, more often than not. So yeah, I usually listen to it with that commentary. But because we download it from High Spots, it didn't appear to have an alternate audio track, so we were left just with the version of In the Building. And I mean, frankly, I prefer a commentary version. I think live, it obviously doesn't matter because you're sort of watching it and you're with your friends, you can sort of chat about the show. But in general, when watching a show, I prefer to listen to the commentary. So, you know, if it were High Spots, I would say, hey, you know, put on the make the secondary track the primary audio for the downloads.
Now, were you at this show live, Todd, or you were just watching? You've watched this show in the past.
No, I was here live. This was the first time watching it since then.
Because I was searching for you in this crowd. Whenever they'd brawl out there, I was looking for Todd Martin from 8 years ago, and I could not spot you. But we were looking.
Yeah, I didn't see myself either. Not that I was particularly looking hard, but yeah, sometimes people notice me doing this or that in some of the shows, but. Yeah, I don't remember because you're not really thinking about the cameras when you're just there. So yeah.
Where exactly did this take place? It looked like some type of a gymnasium with some basketball nets. Where was this?
I'm very glad you brought that up, Wei. This was at the affectionately known Sweatbox, known as the Sweatbox for obvious reasons. This is a Jewish community center in a not so nice area in Hollywood. And that was sort of part of the charm during this time. You'd have this, you know, little rinky-dink. I don't think it was fully like a gymnasium, although they had a basketball hoop there. But it was sort of like you would have like arts and crafts up on the walls. And it was a very small building, and it wasn't air-conditioned. And so even particularly during the summer, it would get really hot, even late at night. And, you know, being that it was a wrestling crowd sort of packed in there, sometimes it wouldn't smell so great. But it sort of would add to the charm. People have their own little fans, and you know the interesting thing about the whole thing was you had this small little building in a Jewish community center in a not so nice neighborhood, and you had 300 people in there, and you had just this incredible lineup of talent, and it really. I think at that point in time, a lot of people probably weren't aware of what sort of talent there was. But I think for the people that were paying attention, they were aware of the sort of talent here. Like I think WWE and TNA, I give them credit because they've become more receptive to bringing in the top independent talent. But at that point in time, I think they sort of had this negative stereotype in their head that like indie guys were all like generic vanilla guys who did flippy doos and had no charisma. And that wasn't the case at all. And, you know, as you see a show here, I mean, you could go to this little show, you know, in front of 300 people in this non-air-conditioned Jewish community center, and you got to see Daniel Bryan, Antonio Cesaro, Evan Bourne, Kevin Steen, El Generico, the Briscoes, Davey Richards, Austin Aries. I mean, it was just this all-star talent, you know, better talent roster, in my opinion, than what WWE had at the time. And it was front of, you know, basically no one in this small little show. So I thought that was part of the charm of it, too.
And this was also that great period, Todd, where, I mean, there was a promotion up here in Toronto at the time that would bring in a lot of the, you know, similar talents every now and then. They had a working agreement with Tori Umon, but also you had TNA on national TV. And at this time, a lot of them, they were allowed to do independent dates, regardless of whether they were going to be appearing on DVDs or not. And when that change occurred, it didn't really make it worth their while for a PWG to bring in a guy like Chris Sabin. But it was great for them. They were getting national exposure and then could do all of these indie dates on top of that.
Yeah, and that's one thing that PWG has benefited from over time, in that they've always maintained good relationships with most people in wrestling. So while some of the other promotions have sort of become entrenched in their own worlds, they've been able to keep good relations and bring in people from different places, to where now, where ROH sort of has their roster, the Dragon Gate USA group has their own roster, but PWG is able to bring in the guys and mix and match and sort of get the best of both worlds there. Not as many TNA guys anymore. In fact, very, very rarely. But it still has, it's sort of the benefit of being able to bring in the best talent from everywhere, as opposed to just sort of having your own little niche group.
The show started off with a tag match with Bino Gambino and Hook Bomberry taking on Alex Kozlov and Ronan. Most will be familiar with Alex Kozlov doing the identical gimmick he is still doing today in New Japan Pro Wrestling, right down to his Russian hat dance that he would do later on in the course of the match. Early on, they got the heat on Bomberry in the corner, big slap spot from Ronan. The referee got distracted as Gambino came in as the illegal man, allowing the heels to double team Bomberry. Finally, Gambino gets the hot tag, comes in, not without his black hat that apparently gave him some kind of big fire-up powers. Bomberry hit the roll of the dice after getting tagged back in pretty damn quickly. It was like, here Gambino gets the hot tag and then just quickly bails here and sends his partner back into the trenches here. There was a springboard cross body to the floor by Kozlov, and it ends with Bomberry countering Ronan off of his shoulders and into a schoolboy for the pin. 10 minutes, 51 seconds. This was your standard get the crowd ready for a long night of wrestling style of opener.
Yeah, I thought it was a good fast-paced tag team opener to start the show. I mean, for me at least, it was obvious that Kozlov was the standout talent amongst this bunch of four. My question is, the most interesting looking guy though of the bunch was definitely Hook Bomberry. The like basically a dude in a cheap Power Rangers Halloween outfit. What is this guy's gimmick, Todd?
I think his gimmick was supposed to be that he was a shooter, a very short shooter. So perhaps Demetrius Johnson, although in not as good of shape. Although I wasn't always that clear on it. He had a tag team. If you notice, Hook Bomberry was and Bino Gambino had another guy in their corner, Top Gun Tawar. Yes. He was one of the founders of PWG, and Top Gun and Hook Bomberry were a tag team for a while called Gunning for Hookers. Top Gun Tawar's gimmick was he was a cocaine addict. Well, I shouldn't say that. He was a cocaine enthusiast. I'm not sure that he was necessarily addicted, but he very much liked cocaine. So maybe Hook Bomberry, given the team name, was very into hookers. That's another possibility. Mm. But yeah, I'm not that clear as to what exactly he was doing.
So this was like if the WWF had gone through with Vic Grimes' key gimmick, this was kind of the metamorphosis that they were hoping for that just didn't really realize itself in the WWF.
Yeah, I always thought that Hook Bomberry would be a good fit for WWE. So, you know, maybe they could still, you know, look him up and bring him in. A couple of other notes, by the way, on this match. Alex Kozlov, like people like have been amused by the fact that Kozlov will sing the Russian national anthem in Japan and get a positive reaction. But in general, he would do that gimmick in PWG from time to time. And he would get a positive reaction sometimes there, too. I mean, it was obviously sort of facetious, but people would, you know, would cheer and then they would chant Russia during some of his matches. You didn't see that during this match, but there was sort of a cult following for him. And Ronan, I thought when you said the guy who stood out the most for you, I thought you were going to bring up Ronan Way, because Ronan, very weird outfit, sort of this big guy, sort of pudgy, a big red outfit, a yellow outfit at one point, and people would chant Hello Kitty at him because his mask looked like Hello Kitty.
That's who I was referring to.
Yes. That's Ronan, the Hello Kitty guy, and Hook Bomberry was on the other team.
I can't believe that, you know, New Japan just held these two big pay-per-views over the last couple of days, and here you have the Sochi Olympics going on, and Alex Kozlov nowhere to be found on either of these New Japan. Like, to me, it's the promo cuts itself essentially right now. I mean, you want some heel heat, you be a Russian right now, defending Mother Russia right now against the ills of the world. We moved on. These were extremely just match ended and boom, we just cut to the next match. There was no come down from the finish.
No, you had to fit as many as you could on.
How long was this show, Todd? Because this couldn't have been no less than 4 hours. The way they cut this thing was 3 hours and they cut out everything in between matches.
Yeah, I don't remember how long this individual show was, but the shows would go very long because later on they got more efficient in running shows. So over time, they would start the shows pretty close to start time. But during the sweatbox days, safe bet was the show was going to start about 45 minutes to an hour late. And then they do all the matches. There would be an intermission for about 20 to 25 minutes in the middle just because people needed to get out in the air because it was so hot in the building. And then obviously all the entrances. Shows would go 5 hours, 5.5 hours sometimes. Yeah, they were long shows.
That's insane. Scorpio Sky, Dr. Shelby, was in action next against Human Tornado, where the stipulation was that if Tornado wins, he gets 5 minutes with valet Jade Chung, native of Toronto, Ontario, represented here on Pro Wrestling Guerrilla. They didn't exactly explain what that meant other than the 5 minutes would be with these two in some sort of interaction. Tornado here. You want to talk about ring gear here, wearing khakis with a black belt. This guy in his absolute finest here for this outing. And the highlight of this for me was these two brawling into the crowd where a basketball came into play, was thrown at Scorpio Sky's head. Tornado then dunked the ball, holding onto the rim, and then from there hit a Hurricane Rana to Scorpio Sky off of this rim. I thought the spot was just incredible. It was great. The match continued. Chung got into the involved in the match, assisting Scorpio Sky with a figure four. Tornado would mount a comeback. One of his highlights being he hit this absolutely shitty Pearl River plunge, but saved it by prefacing it by yelling Ahmed Johnson to everybody and got a two count out of that. Scorpio Sky got an ankle lock. Tornado fought it off. He got the ankle lock again. Tornado making it to the ropes and really trying to sell the ankle. And then another woman comes down. Who was this woman, Todd, that showed up?
This was Candice LeRae, who was in TNA
relatively recently.
Oh, this
is Candice LeRae. Okay, paired with Joey Ryan now. She slaps Sky, and then it leads to an exploder suplex. The referee is distracted. There's a kick out at two. Tornado just gets livid here at this official, yelling, "Where the fuck were you?" And Sky comes back in, hits this brainbuster, and gets the win at 14 minutes and 9 seconds, and Tornado and Jade Chung are denied their 5 minutes.
I thought this was a fun match, some good action, some basic psychology, and even a touch of comedy.
Touch?
Yeah, what? You know, the dunking basketball spot that we often see. I thought Tornado, for a long, lanky dude, I thought he was very athletic and graceful in his high flying in the ring.
Yeah, I always really liked Human Tornado. I thought he was a guy that could have been a star. Great charisma, very likable persona, fun high flying. I think what was his limitation was he wasn't as polished technically as a lot of the guys who got further on. But I thought he was a really good act. And as good as he was as a babyface here, he later turned heel. I was down on it at first because I thought he had such a likable babyface persona, but he turned out to be a great heel too. He had a really good feud with Chris Hero as a heel later on. I really liked him. And Scorpio Sky, you know, you alluded to it, John, probably best known as Harold in the anger management skits in WWE.
Oh, sorry, Harold. Yes, not Dr. Shelby. Yeah.
And then unfortunately was no longer used after making some unfortunate remarks on Twitter about the homosexual community.
Yeah, not always a smart move for Scorpio Sky.
Can you explain to me, Todd, what the end of this match was? Because when Jade Chung goes for that low blow, she starts to sell her arm as if Tornado was wearing a cup, but we never saw him reveal the cup. Was he even wearing a cup, or did he just have like steel balls or something?
No, the gimmick was he's a pimp, so he's got balls of steel. That's, I think, is the gimmick there.
Oh. Yeah,
that's why we need Todd. We need Todd for the context.
Yeah.
Up next, we had Austin Aries, who had been doing the Austin Star gimmick in TNA. Believe he was still with the company at that point doing that gimmick, against a 12-year-old Kevin Steen in this match. Another Canadian here represented on the show. I thought Aries here, just his look at this time, looked closer to Jimmy Jacobs of today than you would the Austin Aries you're used to in 2014. They pretty much started this off based on somebody yelling "Macho Aries" at Austin Aries, and Steen just took this joke and ran and ran and ran, stumbled, and continued to try and run with this joke throughout the entire match as Kevin Hogan doing Hulk Hogan poses. Aries was kind of, I think, realizing this was dying a death, but did it for the amusement, I think, of Steen here. Aries did a lot of his usual spots here, pendulum elbow drop. Steen just no-sells this one spot and goes to rip his shirt off at one point, but can't do it. Aries yells at Steen, "These people don't give a shit about you, fat boy." And Aries then gets poked in the eye, can't see here as he's running the ropes and runs into a power slam. Aries then recovers, can't lift Steen up, but ducks away from a package pile driver attempt. Steen goes to the floor. Aries hits his suicide dive under the middle rope, and then a double sledge off the top. The savage elbow drop for the amusement of about five people in the crowd. And then Steen reverses, holds Aries upside down, and ends up hitting the package pile driver. They went 16 minutes and 14 seconds. I found this somewhat underwhelming. I think Kevin Steen, night and day between 2006, 2014, and this was, I was just amazed at just how youthful this man looked with a clean-shaven Kevin Steen.
Well, this really wasn't a typical Kevin Steen nor Austin Aries match. I don't know if the mandate, for them to, when they started, was to go comedy, but this was pretty much strictly a comedy matchup between these two. And I thought it was fun. I mean, I thought it was cool that, you wouldn't even get to see this, I think, too much, in Ring of Honor right now, much less TNA, where you get to see these two guys not have a typical match and basically show off their comedic chops. And I thought Austin Aries, excelled at that. But I do agree with you that I think he went a little too much at times. You could tell the crowd was getting a little restless towards the end, where they actually wanted these guys to turn it up and actually wrestle. But instead, it was just a fun, lighthearted mid-card comedy match, I thought.
I liked the match. I thought I really enjoyed the comedy of it. And you guys sort of hit on a couple of things about this I wanted to bring up. First is sort of the evolution of Kevin Steen. You touched on this, John, in that he was a lot thinner at this point, for starters. Clean-shaven. And this was during the period that Steen was sort of evolving in PWG. And PWG, as a promotion, at the beginning, they brought in ROH guys and TNA guys, and they just sort of matched them up. But over time, PWG became a platform and a springboard for a lot of guys, and Kevin Steen is one of the best examples. He's a guy who really made his name in PWG. He was working in Quebec. Mm-hmm. He was successful there, but that wasn't really getting him noticed in the larger North American scene. And he came into PWG as the fake Super Dragon and interfered with Super Dragon, which Super Dragon was the top guy at that point. So that was a big push from the very beginning. They had a very violent feud. Kevin Steen was a really hardcore heel, more along the lines of what he would do years later. But this was during the period where you could see him evolving, where he was changing from sort of the really heavy heel into the lighter, more comedy-oriented character that he would be for a lot longer in his PWG run. So you could sort of see that here. I think that also touches on one of the reasons I think people, the wrestlers, enjoyed working with PWG is that in a lot of cases there weren't a lot of storylines going into the matches. In a match like this, in other promotions, they'd sort of have an idea of this is what you're going to do. We're going to tell this specific story. Whereas here, I got the impression they went out there and like you guys said, somebody yelled out, you know, Macho Aries, and they decided, hey, what the hell? Let's do a comedy match built around Hogan and Savage. And sort of they clearly had a lot of fun working each other. They sort of did what they wanted to do, and they had a lot of freedom to just put together a match however they wanted. And you know, you may not always be a fan of the direction that that takes you. And this plays into what we're going to talk about later with the Danielson-Claudio match. But I think that freedom and that sort of creativity, not only does it frequently lead to positive benefits in the ring, but I think it also is something that the wrestlers themselves enjoy.
I think it's also, you know, it requires almost an educated audience like this to be able to, you know, play with them and kind of have a match of this type and that, you know, Claudio Danielson match later on. I mean, I don't know if a match like this would necessarily be, you know, be reacted to so positively on a TNA show, for instance.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it plays to the fact that they were responding to what the crowd was doing as opposed to sort of coming up with an idea in advance and then trying to sell the crowd on it.
Tag match was next with Rocky Romero and TJ Perkins taking on Disco Machine and Nemesis. Very technical back and forth start with Disco Machine and Romero early on. Machine starts ramming Rocky's head into the turnbuckle, does this about 20 times, and then lets go, and Romero is still feeling the effects, putting himself into the turnbuckle. I was amused by that spot. Machine and Nemesis, they double-team Perkins behind the referee's back. All four get in the ring with running kicks to the chest by the babyfaces. I think Rocky Romero, he is so fluid, and I think he's one of the guys that during this whole mid-2000s rise of a lot of different independent talent, I think Romero isn't always put in that same cluster, and I think he really is somewhat overlooked by people. He gets a straight armbar on Nemesis, makes it to the ropes, and then Perkins goes for a crossbody to take Nemesis to the floor. They bail out under the bottom, leaving a Disco Machine to hit a choke slam into a backbreaker for the clean pin at 15 minutes, 41 seconds.
I thought all four guys were working hard here, but it seemed to me the reactions for this were a little bit lukewarm, and like even at one point I noticed the crowd just kind of telling these guys, yelling at them to end the match. Not entirely sure why. I thought they were doing pretty good. I could only assume that maybe it was, you know, people were getting a little tired at this point.
Yeah, I thought the match was a little bit flat myself. One note on Rocky Romero that you brought up, John. I give Romero a lot of credit in that he was a guy that at this point in time to me was very technically proficient, but was a guy that didn't have the total package. He didn't have a lot of charisma, I didn't think. He didn't really connect with the crowds. A problem that also, you know, interestingly enough, his tag team partner in this match, TJ Perkins, was a problem that he had. And
right.
Perkins, to me, is a guy that never really connected with the crowds, whereas Rocky Romero, I think he really has found a way to connect with the crowds. I really like the Forever Hooligans now, and I think Rocky Romero is a guy who, you know, it took him some time, but I think he really figured out an identity for himself. And it really got him a lot farther in the business than I think he was back here when he was probably best known for his tag team with Ricky Reyes.
I don't know about you guys, but watching this match, it made me think, yeah, what the hell happened to Manic on TNA? Haven't seen this guy in months. They did this whole video. He gets his contract and gets to sign it. I haven't even noticed that this guy had completely disappeared off the face of the earth. PWG title match, Joey Ryan defending the championship against Chris Sabin. Now, Joey Ryan, I'm sure many people familiar with his stuff in TNA, but obviously a cornerstone in Pro Wrestling Guerrilla dating back to its inception. And having a limited look at him in PWG, Todd, I really get the sense here that there were people that loved this character and others that absolutely hated this character that they had.
That is a very correct assessment, and I was on the negative side on this one. And the key is the character, because I was never down on Joey Ryan himself. I thought he was fine as a performer, but and you know what? It wasn't even the character. It was the booking of the character. And why don't you sort of go into the match and we can talk about it at the end, because it very much plays into the story of this match.
Well, Ryan is in the ring. He is wearing a medal that he had just got from the Best of the American Super Juniors. This brought up a Die Joey Die chant from the audience. The crowd was very much into Sabin, who had the early advantage taking the beginning of a portion of the match. Ryan eventually got the advantage, and T's doing something huge, and it built up to a rear chin lock to get heat out of the crowd. Sabin is staggering off the ropes at this point and does the old Sting flop spot down into Joey Ryan's groin, and this brings out a chant of Joey liked it, and then as the chant died, some dude yelled, "Because you're gay," at Joey Ryan, the subtlety of pro wrestling gorilla here. Sabin hits this great tornado DDT off the ropes, and who was the special referee in this, Todd? I didn't catch the name or his significance here to this.
That was Dino. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I didn't understand who it was and what it kind of tied into with these two.
That was Dino Winwood. He was the I forget what the title was, but essentially the commissioner of PWG at that time. And Joey Ryan had been running roughshod, so Dino Winwood wanted to get the title off of Joey Ryan. And Dino actually for a while was doing the this gimmick with together with SoCal Val, who later became a part of TNA. But I think she had left at this point to join TNA, and so he was the full time guy for that.
Well, for me watching this, not knowing that context, I mean, it almost painted, you know, Joey Ryan here as having to fight these odds here against not only Sabin, but also this referee. The referee at one point stops Sabin from diving to the floor. Ryan runs in with a belt shot, and he's prodding Dino to disqualify him. And the bell is rung, but the referee gets the microphone. He is not going to disqualify Ryan. And then Dino gets taken out with a belt shot by Ryan. Sabin then hits the cradle shock, still goes for the pin as another referee runs in. And as he's counting, they do the pull-out spot with Scorpio Sky pulling that referee to the floor. Sabin hits a suicide dive and goes into a chair upon landing. And then Sabin applies a reverse figure four. Ryan is tapping out. The bell is called. Sabin is then ruled the winner by disqualification. And Sabin is just pissed here that he has not won the PWG title. I wasn't a big fan of this. I was confused at points, and it was, I don't know, just I've not been a giant fan of Joey Ryan, but I haven't seen much of his PWG stuff to, you know, get a big sense of the character.
Yeah, I think, I mean, much of this probably had to do with our lack of familiarity with the storylines, with the lack of commentary, too. It seemed to be a match that was really kind of more storyline and character-based than, you know, in-ring. I thought in-ring it was solid, but nothing really out of the ordinary.
Yeah, so basically what was going on at this point was Joey Ryan had been the PWG champion for a little while, and the gimmick was that Joey Ryan would find some sleazy, underhanded way of pulling out the win or keeping the title month after month. And it would always be some sort of weird creative finish. This one was, you know, sort of a straightforward dusty finish. But they did all sorts of – I'm even forgetting them all. But they were all sort of elaborate screw job finishes. And to me, it was unfulfilling to come to the show every month. And you get this PWG title match in the middle of the card. And you knew it was going to end with some sort of screw job. And Joey Ryan, you know, using some sort of chicanery to win. And I like indie wrestling where you get more in the way of clean finishes, not in the way of sort of nothing being settled. So I wasn't a big fan of that. And I will say in its defense, though, that towards the end of this title run, after Joey had been just, you know, doing this month after month after month, he did get a lot of heat for a few of his sort of later title defenses against, I recall B-Boy and Human Tornado in particular. I could be wrong on one of those. I know B-Boy, there's a big cage match that he had. And by that point, people really wanted Joey Ryan to lose the title. And so that did get a lot of heat. But in general, that was sort of the idea they're going for here with Joey Ryan. I wasn't a big fan of it either, knowing the context better, and you guys, you know, not knowing it as well.
Was Sabin doing like fairly regular shows with PWG? Was this kind of just a one-off?
No, he was fairly regular. Okay. In fact, yeah, before the TNA sort of cut them off, he, if I recall correctly, was the TNA guy that they would book the most frequently. Sometimes he would team with Alex Shelley. Sometimes he would do singles. They used him a lot, though.
Tag match was next with the Briscoe brothers against El Generico and Quicksilver. Generico and Jay Briscoe start the match. They did some lucha spots together. The crowd was very much into the character of Generico. I really enjoyed the Briscoes here. They had these shorts on where Mark's read "tough to hit" and Jay's just simply stated 40 ounce. whatever he was trying to insinuate here. Quicksilver applied a octopus submission onto Jay. Jay and Mark started double teaming and getting the heat, making just tags frequently. Big pop for a double shoulder block spot to Quicksilver, and then to the spot where they lifted and tossed him high in the air, landing him on the mat. And then Generico, who I just thought was the highlight of this match, just some incredible stuff here. A springboard into an acai moonsault off the top as the crowd starts singing Olé. He gets back on the apron, and then Mark hits a flying Hurricane Rana from the ring to the floor in midair. Jay then hits a press slam into a DVD. Just tons of big spots here. Briscoe's attempted a springboard doomsday device, but Quicksilver countered that with a victory roll, getting a two count as they got into the near falls. There was one kind of messed up spot where Mark was coming off the top to knock Generico off the shoulders of Jay and didn't come across too fluidly. And then Quicksilver leapt over top into a sunset flip powerbomb to Mark Briscoe. There was a reverse head scissors by Quicksilver, followed by a brainbuster by Generico to pin Jay. 18 minutes and 2 seconds. I just thought that this match really flowed well. You had a lot of big spots that the crowd responded to in kind and didn't drag at all, despite being, you know, 18 minutes and a couple matches away from the main event.
Yeah, I like this match a lot, too. I mean, I thought it was sort of, you know, some people could argue that this was sort of your typical indie-level spot fest with maybe too many big spots towards the end. But, I mean, I feel like if you're going to pay to go watch an indie wrestling match, and this is sort of the style that you'd expect. And I thought it was a lot of fun, and I thought the Briscoes were awesome to watch with their very aggressive style.
Yeah, I also thought this was a really fun match. To me, the guy that is the biggest star, if you're going to associate PWG with one guy, to me it's Generico. Mm-hmm. He's obviously, you know, he's not originally from there, but he was a guy that, you know, just like Kevin Steen, he made his rep in PWG. He would fly down from Quebec with Kevin Steen. He had this goofy gimmick, the thin physique. He wasn't a guy that when I started going to these shows ever would have conceived of as him being a WWE guy in the future. And that wasn't true. A lot of these guys I thought could be WWE guys down the line, even though they were sort of smaller in stature. Generico was not a guy I thought on that line. But God damn it, if you went and you paid your money to see El Generico, he would give you everything he had month after month after month, year after year after year. That guy worked so hard to have the best possible the match that he could every single time. He's like the, you know, he's the guy, he's the undrafted free agent in the NFL who goes out there and earns his, you know, job in training camp, racks up all the tackles, does it without a lot of, you know, without a lot of thanks, without a lot of help along the way, and just earns it all his way. I can't say enough about El Generico. Quicksilver, a very good performer in his own right. They were known as Cape Fear at this point because they both wore capes. And the Briscoes themselves, I've always been a big fan of the Briscoes, but I particularly like them during this stage because they brought such a feeling of violence behind their matches. They would go in there and they would just fight people. And I think over time they sort of became more comfortable with a safer style, which I don't fault them for. It's better for them. But at this point, you know, there was sort of a brutality to the Briscoes that I really liked. And they had something of a sketchy history with PWG. They no-showed a number of events. At one point, I'm pretty sure that PWG cut a, I forget who it was, but at the beginning of the show, it might have been Excalibur, cut a promo and said they were never going to use them again. They ended up bringing them back anyway because the Briscoes are so talented, but sort of a, you know, sort of an interesting contrast between Generico, who really gave everything to this promotion, and the Briscoes, guys who are very talented, but perhaps didn't have as much loyalty to PWG as some guys.
One of the highlights of WrestleMania weekend last year was going to the two of us, along with Todd, going to the ROH pay-per-view on the Friday night and spotting Papa Briscoe two rows ahead of us with the whole Briscoe clan. And I was as much focused on this family and their reactions to watching wrestling as I was to anything in the ring that night.
That's right. There were Briscoes all around us.
There were Briscoe babies. There were Briscoe cousins. This family, my goodness, more branches than you could imagine. And then we go to the match I am most excited to discuss.
This, by the way, was the reason I suggested the show to you originally.
Because Todd gave me this teaser that there is one particular match that I don't know if you're familiar with or not, but I think that's why we should. So the whole show I'm watching this, and I'm like, what is it? And then this match hit. Claudio Castagnoli and Bryan Danielson A rematch from last week on SmackDown, no less. This was during Bryan Danielson's lengthy run as ROH champion. No reference to that in this particular match. And the match begins. Claudio has these just hideous yellow and blue tights with a dollar sign on them. There's a technical match right from the start. Complete contrast to the last match, and crowd seemed to just be really into this battle for positioning and when one would get a slight advantage. And then Claudio starting to take a cheap shot every now and then, hitting Danielson in the face. And then he took his arm and wrapped it around the head of Bryan Danielson for a headlock. And I wrote down on my notes, this headlock has lasted a couple of minutes. It went for 10 minutes and 56 seconds. This headlock, this whole match was built around Claudio squeezing Bryan Danielson's head as Bryan tried to escape. The crowd started to boo this. There were times they loved this. They then broke into a chant of "We want wrestling," and it all led to Danielson finally getting out of this and rolls him up with an O'Connor roll. At 16:47, he instantly escapes this headlock and secures the victory. I fucking love this, and I think there is no opinion other than you loved it or fucking thought this was terrible. But I am planting my flag, and I thought this was great. I was completely transfixed for this entire headlock spot.
Yeah, I thought this was awesome. I mean, the crowd at one point starts chanting, "We want wrestling," followed by another section of the crowd telling those people to shut the fuck up and chanting, "This is wrestling." And I thought this was amazing because, you know, you can look it up and down this card. I mean, a lot of these matches, the comedy match aside, a lot of these matches typically look the same. They kind of fit that, you know, indie wrestling kind of template. This was just so simple. Obviously, it could have turned out very terrible. We're going to base a whole 15-minute match around one headlock. But it was executed brilliantly, fantastically well, just telling one single story. You know, this guy gets in a headlock, is doing everything he can to try to get out, and the other guy is doing everything he can to keep it on through a number of, you know, I mean, I think it takes some appreciation to, you know, and some knowledge of just how difficult this is for them to pull this off.
Yeah,
what were you chanting, Todd? What were you chanting during this match?
I wasn't chanting because here's the thing. At the time, I was on the negative side in the sense that, like, it was for a completely different standpoint, though. Like, at this point, you know, like, I would go to these PWG shows based on the lineup. So some months I wouldn't go if it wasn't as good of a lineup. I saw this lineup. I saw Bryan Danielson, Claudio Castagnoli. This was, you know, one of the matches, if not the match on the entire show I was looking forward to the most. So, like, I wanted to see a bunch of stuff with Danielson and Claudio at the time. So at the time, I felt like I had missed out a little bit, but I had so much respect for both these guys that I wasn't going to be disrespectful. So I was just sort of like, you know, like I was a little frustrated because I, you know, I was there live. I wanted to see a little bit more. Now watching it, you know, however many years later, 8 years later, and not having that context of having, you know, paid my $30 and, you know, come out into this, you know, hot building in the middle of Hollywood, I very much enjoyed this match on second viewing. I thought it was so much fun with them trying to get out of this headlock, even knowing how the whole thing ended. I thought the thing held up very well, and I very much enjoyed it on second viewing. And this speaks to what we were talking about earlier, sort of the benefits of sort of being able to experiment. I mean, this was a very much sort of an avant-garde match, you know, is them thinking outside the box, doing something different. And you know, you could sort of, I think sometimes when you make, you know, when you take creative challenges, sometimes people are going to like it, sometimes people aren't going to like it. And, you know, this was a polarizing match, but on second viewing, I thought it was a very fun and different match.
I really like the confidence these two had to go out there knowing this could absolutely bomb and being willing to risk that here in front of an audience that, yeah, is probably made up of a lot of people who are expecting that kind of match of the year kind of performance from these two. And I just thought that it was so different. And had I gone to this show, maybe I would have had the same reaction as Todd. But years later, to be able to say I was at the headlock match and everyone knows what that means, to me, that's the match that would stand out apart. I wish that, you know, Saturday Morning Slam was still around because I could see these two trying to, like, replicate something like this on that kind of a show.
Yep.
So those were our thoughts. on the real main event here of Enchantment Under the Sea. And Matt Sydal and B-Boy had to follow this, and they went out there for close to 19 minutes. Of course, Matt Sydal, you probably aren't familiar with Evan Bourne because he, much like Manic, completely disappeared. Sydal would, I just found that Sydal, you know, I've always been a fan of this guy and what he can do in a ring. Talking during a match, not one of those things. My God, this man, like Bob Backlund level of, you know, personality here that he exhibited. And this is pre-1994 Bob Backlund. Sydal was taking most of the match. You know, offense wasn't as crisp as it would later become with him, where he would become a very fluid flyer. B-Boy sends him into the second turnbuckle, dropkicks Sydal in the corner. Sydal gets seated, and B-Boy hits a stomp from behind from the second turnbuckle. There was a Hurricane Rana attempt that's blocked, and B-Boy powerbombs Sydal for a two count. Sydal hit a big moonsault to the floor, and then they went into a bunch of bridging near falls, a Texas cloverleaf. B-Boy comes off the turnbuckle into a spinning heel kick in midair, and then Sydal followed that with a standing moonsault for a near fall, a gut wrench slam for a two. He still can't do it, to the point that his voice just can't compel him, and he yells out, "What do I have to do?" This was just outstanding. Cobra clutch slam, shining wizard by B-Boy for a two count. Then he calls for the GTS, which is blocked, and Sydal hits a Hurricane Rana, gets a two count, but then B-Boy comes back with a lariat and then hits the GTS as Kenta's influence felt beyond CM Punk here in 2006, and B-Boy gets the win at 18 minutes and 56 seconds.
I'm glad you mentioned that about Matt Sydal, because that was sort of my takeaway from this.
What do I have to do?
I mean, besides his, you know, his great mobility, his great precision, and just the finesse that he exhibits, but man, earlier, like, he goes through a big sequence, finally locks on a hold, and shouts, "Yeah!" So it's like audience members even pick this up and start like mocking him, mockingly shout "Yeah!" in response. Same thing. You know, maybe a guy that's probably better left just doing his talking in the ring, not literally, but with his moves.
A couple thoughts. First, John, you mentioned Bob Backlund and sort of his pre-crazy guy gimmick. Have you guys watched any of his like 70s title matches anytime recently?
Not recently, but I have seen you know, bits and pieces here and there.
Because knowing what about you, Wei?
No, I have not.
Because knowing what he has sort of become in the recent years, there is tremendous unintentional comedy value to some of those matches, because you can see the sort of wild man in him, and he's doing sort of like traditional babyface spots, but he seems kind of unhinged while he's doing them. They're sort of, looking back at the whole thing, some of those, you know, 70s matches where he's working against sort of the generic heel of the moment, there's some perverse entertainment out of them, sort of similar to Matt Sydal here. One other thought on this match, I think you guys sort of hit the key points here, is I'm a big fan of B-Boy. Like, I think he's sort of an underrated guy, someone that I think a lot of East Coast fans may not be as familiar with. Good wrestler, kind of a similar gimmick and style to the Homicide, who he teamed with and feuded with over the years. And he never really, I think, sort of reached sort of a particular level of notoriety, but I thought he was a very solid performer.
Main event time. It was the tag titles here were headlining the show with champions Davey Richards and Super Dragon. This was actually 2 weeks before Davey Richards would wrestle his first match in Ring of Honor, taking on Scott Lost and Chris Bosh. And I was thinking, Todd, was part of your reason for picking this because of the Toronto influence here of me and Wei and Chris Bosh headlining the show?
I wish I could have thought that. If someone named Jose Calderon was on the show, maybe.
Now, we talked about Matt Sydal and his proclivity for talking during the match. On the flip side, we have Davey Richards, who his gimmick here seemed to be like he's just an asshole. An asshole who shit-talks throughout his entire match. He's, like, ripping on Scott Law, saying he's just mad because I kicked his ass at the Super 8. Match begins, and he's, like, just, like, that like, father at his kid's soccer game as he's coaching Super Dragon. Come on, Dragon, get out, come on. Just, man, You can take this many different ways. And then he gets in with Chris Bosch and announces, school's in session, bitch. I don't think that there was any redeeming value here to Davey Richards. But he's just this phenomenal athlete who's like a real giant prick about it. And I think that this is undiscovered territory for Davey Richards. If his big hang-up is a lack of a personality, it was coming out in droves for me in this main event. This match, we won't go through everything. This was your marathon main event. They went close to 31 minutes here. A lot of cool stuff here. It is what you would, some people love, other people criticize the most about Davey Richards of so much in one match, but this was your main event that you were presenting all of this in. There was this crazy vertical suplex spot with Richards and Lost as they went over the top. And as Richards lands, he grabs his left knee and is playing it off that his knee is legitimately fucked by yelling, "Oh, fuck! Not again! Not again!" You could question. I've never torn my ACL, Todd, but I don't know if I'd be yelling, "Not again!" And he's calling for Rick, and everyone's stopping. They're concerned. They waited a solid minute before someone had to yell out a wisecrack for some levity here in the arena. What were you thinking, Todd? Were you hooked here by this injury spot at the time?
To be honest, I don't remember.
Well, he's selling the knee, and we're insinuating that this match has now become a shoot because the match continues and Scott Lost attacks the knee and Richards is asking, "Are you stupid? I guess to infer that you should be working my good knee because there's a real injury that has trumped things." If this happened in WCW, we would be shitting this a new toilet. But it was it worked into the rest of the match as they would constantly attack the knee of Davey using a figure four. Richard would have to fight back. Super Dragon came in, hit a curb stomp to Scott Lost. Richards gets tagged out as his knee is in shambles here. I mean, we have, you know, potentially a Juliana Pena situation here. And Super Dragon works for 30 seconds and then tags this guy back in. Like, what a dick here. Referee's back is turned as Joey Ryan shows up and gives a belt shot to Davey Richards. He kicks out of the belt shot. Scorpio Sky comes in and power bombs him into they take Scorpio Sky, and Super Dragon goes for a power bomb as Davey hits him with a code breaker, not compromising the knee at all here. And then Scott Lost hits a Michinoku driver. There's a sharpshooter applied to Davey Richards, and they lift Richards' arm up three times. And for one of the first times in wrestling, the arm goes down at 30 minutes, 54 seconds, as Scott Lost and Chris Bosch win the tag titles. And Dragon then gets laid out on the floor as Bosch and Lost, they are celebrating with the titles. And before we get to all the post-match, your thoughts first weigh on the match.
Well, this is one of the matches that didn't particularly stand out to me amongst the card. I thought, portions of it were technically sound. You can't doubt that. But the selling of the leg, I thought it was a bit of a overacting from Richards. It didn't really work for me. And I also admit that by this point, I was pretty tired just of watching these kind of bunch of power moves and near falls over and over again throughout the whole card.
Yeah, it was sort of a long show by this point, and this match went on for a long time. A few sort of background notes for you guys. Chris Bosch and Scott Lost were a frequent tag team in Southern California. They were known as Arrogance. They were sort of a regular tag team there. Lost was, I always thought, sort of a solid technician, not a lot of charisma, whereas Bosch was more exuberant, not as technical. On the other side, you had Super Dragon and Davey Richards. Super Dragon, to me, I always really like Super Dragon. Super Dragon's a guy who can be polarizing. He does have his critics because his weight fluctuated sometimes, and he did have a propensity for both injuring guys and injuring himself because he had a very brutal style. But I thought he was so entertaining to watch. Like the Briscoes, it felt like he was in a fight. His big moves, like the curb stomp and the psycho driver, just looked so good in terms of like just looking like devastating moves, and he would almost always have really exciting matches. So I thought very highly of Super Dragon, and Davey was another guy like Steen and Generico who really made his name at first in PWG, and this This was another reason sort of I was thinking this might be one of the cards we want to talk about, because this was the point when Davey Richards was being elevated. This tag team with Super Dragon was designed to build Davey Richards up to that next level, and he would be at that next level for basically the remainder of his independent career. Super Dragon was the big star of the promotion, and Davey Richards teaming with them was the way to give him the rub, and they were the tag team as just sort of these big, you know, really, like you brought up, John, they were just assholes, but they were fan-favorite assholes, you know, like I mean, maybe not Steve Austin, but just sort of, you know, jerks and badasses who would kick people's asses. And my favorite Davey Richards and Super Dragon matches were really the ones where they were on the most offense. Like, you know, they could sell fine, but I remember them having this crazy match with Los Luchas, which was just basically a squash match. They just basically destroyed these guys in what I think was the main event of that show. And it was so much fun. So Davey and Super Dragon, I think, were really clicking there. They had a phenomenal, one of my favorite all-time PWG matches around this time against Roderick Strong and DC mayoral candidate Jack Evans. Really good match, worth checking out. And yeah, what to say about this match in specific? Yeah, not a lot to add beyond that, I guess.
DC mayoral candidate Jack Evans.
Yes, yeah. There's a guy running for DC a mayor named Jack Evans. So I have to see DC Jack Evans for mayor all over the place. I'm greatly amused by it as a fan of Jack.
You know, as someone that's grown up in Washington, Todd, and you lived through Mary and Barry, and we're now kind of going through it. Any advice for us about a mayor that has, you know, certain substance issues which seem to be compounding on itself?
Just enjoy the ride. I think that Rob Ford has more fun visuals throughout this whole thing.
Yes.
But Mary and Barry still has the best quote of all. So we'll see how Ford can do in the following years.
After the match, all the heels were celebrating here with Scorpio Sky and Joey Ryan part of it. They take out the referee. They continue to just kill Super Dragon here. 4-on-1, they give him a curb stomp. They apply a sharpshooter, placing his head onto a chair in the seated position and hit a double foot stomp onto his head on the chair. Chris Bosch delivers that. Sky cuts a promo talking about how he's taking these men to hell to fight the devil himself. Which, based on the heat in this venue, probably felt like hell. And then they set up two tables on the floor and took the longest time here setting up Dragon, to the point the crowd was just hating Joey Ryan here as he hit the spinning neckbreaker to Dragon off the second rope through the tables on the floor. Bosch says that all of the fans can, quote, eat his ass out because he will be PWG champion, which was odd considering this alliance here with the PWG champion. This is the highlight of the whole show. They cut to Davey Richards, who is over top a fallen Super Dragon, and says, "You want war, motherfucker?" And says he's coming for them. And he will win the PWG title. He hugs Super Dragon. This felt like The Sopranos as it was going out. And they basically cut the video short because American Dragon is, like, not breathing now. And we go off the air thinking this man may have died to end the show. But Davey Richards is going to honor his memory by winning this title back as the locker room comes out to assist the dead dragon here. This was quite the angle to end the show, Todd. Death.
He's out cold, man. He's out cold.
This was
go ahead, man.
Oh, no, nothing. I really have nothing to add. I mean, again, I feel like, you know, David Richards perhaps overacting a little here in this.
Maybe not enough. I like this version of Davey Richards. I mean, I might have sounded critical, but I thought that this did add a certain edge to his personality that sometimes was non-existent, you know, especially during that run as ROH champion, that it was kind of, you know, you had the in-ring skill set, but you didn't really have that kind of edge to him that this match really was just full of.
Yeah, I very much like Davey Richards during this period, and I still like Davey Richards, but I thought he was doing a good job. I think the Chris Bosch promo that you brought up was even better than sort of a few other points that were amusing about the whole thing. He talked about how PWG has jobbed him out, so he's apparently going to start shooting from now on. And he also said that he's been held down by the PWG 6. Now, I'm not sure if you guys are familiar with the PWG 6, but they're the 6 founders of the company.
Yes.
Hook Bomberry, who we talked about earlier, Excalibur, Disco Machine, Super Dragon, Joey Ryan and Scott Lost. So you had Chris Bosh was angry at his tag team partner and the guy that he had just formed an alliance with, and he was going to show them by winning the PWG singles title. This was an interesting way of starting a heel faction, and they were known as the Dynasty, and that was sort of the jumping point off for them. My favorite memory of the Dynasty was, and I'm sure this isn't on the DVD anywhere because they don't have the rights to it, but they had a tremendous night at some point after this where they all kept coming out to the Run DMC DMX theme, the Run DMC D-Generation X theme.
Oh, yes.
The Kings of Rock one. They all came out, if I recall correctly, wearing green and doing crotch chops and just dancing all over the building. It was tremendous, hilarious entertainment that I remember as the highlight of this Dynasty heel faction. And as for the angle, I didn't think it particularly worked as well as I think they thought it would when laying out.
Well, Super Dragon did not die at the end of this this show, not to give out any spoilers from 2006, but that capped off Enchantment Under the Sea, a show I very much enjoyed, and when I go back, I will always think of the headlock match on this particular event, and I give this one a 7.5 out of 10. Way yourself, what did you think about our maiden voyage with PWG?
I thought it was fun. I thought it was. I mean, anytime you watch a new promotion, I think there's a bit of novelty attached to it. I thought it was a little bit long towards the end, but I thought it offered enough kind of variance. I kind of wish there was a little bit more that was different on the show. But in particular, I really like the I like the Aries Steen match, and I also like the Castagnoli Danielson match. So I give this a 7 out of 10.
Did this hold up for you, Todd, from a live perspective versus viewing it that many years later?
I enjoyed the show. I mean, I was a little nervous watching it because, like, when I was going back through, I was like, the thing was, I chose this when I suggested a few shows to you. I was thinking more in terms of what would make for a good discussion point more than just the shows that I remember having the most awesome matches. So I thought there was a lot to discuss on this show. And as I was watching it, I was like, man, maybe I should have thrown out, you know, one of those bolo shows where you just had like two or three, you know, 4-star plus matches in a row where, you know, you could really sort of be blown away by the experience. I was a little nervous and you'd think, what's all this talk about PWG about? But I thought it was a fun show, like you guys said. And if you enjoyed this, you know, hopefully it'll whet your appetite because there's a lot of really great stuff that's, you know, even much better than this one.
Any show, Todd, with basketballs to the cranium, 10-minute headlocks, and threats of eating one's ass out, I think that there are no less than a bunch of talking points to come out of a particular show. Can you stick around, Todd, for feedback? Because we do have some questions for you from some of our listeners amongst the feedback today.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, let's start off with Tam, writing in from England. I've never seen a PWG event, I'm sad to say, but I have heard great stuff about the promotion. I'm looking forward to you guys discussing this. Do you guys feel, and let's throw the Todd because he'd be the best one to answer it, do you feel that PWG needs to go on iPay-per-view at some stage? As someone who has never seen the promotion before and has no idea what events are the best, can you suggest some DVDs I should be looking at ordering to see some of the best stuff PWG has put out?
Okay, as to the iPay-per-views, my understanding is that if they ran iPay-per-views, it would limit their access to talent because some of the other promotions that have some of these guys locked up, specifically ROH and Dragon Gate USA, have limitations in terms of running opposition iPay-per-views. So I think that's the reason why they don't do iPay-per-views, although I'm not certain of that. As for shows to look up, the nice thing about PWG is that the quality of the shows is consistently very high. I don't ever recall going to a bad PWG show because they just load it up with really good talent. It's hard to have a bad show when you've got a lot of really good talent on the show. The very best shows, I mean, there have been a bunch of sort of one-off really good shows, but to me, a good entry point, if you're looking to get into it, would be to order one of the Battle of Los Angeles tournaments. Those were sort of not the first one though. The first one wasn't as good, so I'd recommend doing the second or the third or the fourth or the fifth Battle of Los Angeles. That's their big tournament at the end of the summer. and they, you know, bring in a lot of really good wrestlers, and they've had different size tournaments. It's been 16. It's been, I think they did 24. They might have even done 32 one year. Really good tournaments with all sorts of, you know, really good wrestlers from around the world. And those have produced some of their best matches of the year. If you're into tag team wrestling, their DDT tournaments, tag team tournaments have also been really good. But yeah, I'd recommend the Battle of Los Angeles. And I haven't been to a PWG show in a couple of years because when I've been back to Los Angeles, I've been trying to time it around big UFC events in Vegas, and it just hasn't lined up. But I've been sort of having a hankering for some live PWG. I'm thinking of heading out to the Battle of Los Angeles this year, which is sort of a testament to the quality of the show to, you know, fly across the country for a PWG event.
We got a Christian Small next who says, I've been a PWG fan for a few years now. All the shows I've watched are from the small arena in Reseda, California. The atmosphere and crowds are just insane on every show. I was wondering if Todd has ever been to that arena and what it was like. Was this show there, or is he talking about a different arena in Reseda?
No, that would be the later arena that they would. They ran a number of buildings over the years. The one that we watched was probably their second most used venue, and Reseda is by far and away their most used one. I've been to a ton of shows there, and as I said, it's just a great environment for wrestling. I mean, it's not the greatest building you're ever going to see. It's just sort of you know, it's just a 500-seat building with, you know, I think it's an old, I don't even know what it is originally. There's like a bar there with sort of an old guy who sort of has his own little way of doing things. And, yeah, I don't even know what to say about it. Just sort of in the valley, and it's just sort of a building. There's nothing special about the building. The special thing about the shows there is the crowd and the wrestlers and what they give in the building.
We go to Rob from Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. Thanks, guys, for finally reviewing a PWG event. This was a notable show in that it was the debut of The Dynasty, a group which played a large part in PWG for some time to come. An amazing show that was one of the best PWG shows up to this point in time. One could easily say that 6 of the 9 matches were 3 stars at least. Claudio and Brian, in retrospect, was a disappointment, although obviously 9 years ago, neither was as polished as they are now. I will dispute that claim, Rob. I'm a huge fan of PWG, and at times I try not to think about how much I've spent on DVDs from them. They have some of the best fans in all of wrestling. All of the wrestlers reward them by working their asses off every single show. For anybody looking to get into PWG, the Bola events and DDT4, which Todd just mentioned, are ones to go out and check.
David Duffenberg. I have an odd question. On paper, Kenny Omega versus Bryan Danielson seems like a classic, but was everyone in the crowd satisfied with their comedic masterpiece with John Jacob Jingleheimer Schmidt? Seems like that could be only pulled off in PWG, and I was almost in tears at home watching it. Also, have fans ever left unhappy? PWG seems to make all the right moves, just wondering if they've ever done something like WWE did by leaving Daniel Bryan out of the Rumble.
I guess there was some dissatisfaction as we're talking about the Joey Ryan title reign. And obviously sometimes they would put over certain guys, and sometimes they would turn guys, and the turns wouldn't work either because the people were with the guys they wanted to be heels, or because they weren't particularly. No, usually it was that way. Not really so much problems with faces getting over. So yeah, when I think of the fans not really being that receptive, it was usually to do with trying to use guys as heels that the crowd wasn't really buying in that capacity.
Jake writes in from the UK, very excited for this review. I haven't had a chance to watch this show yet, but if it's anything like modern PWG, it's surely fantastic and on paper seems to have tons of star power. As far as indie wrestling goes, Pro Wrestling Guerrilla is easily the best in the US, if not the world, and I really feel more people should be aware of it. For me, there is only one constant and consistent wrestling promotion, and that is this particular company. I don't think I can rely on WWE, TNA, or even ROH anymore to deliver me my wrestling fix, so I'm glad you guys are giving this company some spotlight. PWG is famous for its crowd heat and reaction, so my question for Todd is, what is his favorite PWG live experience or a particular match that comes to mind?
Well, I mentioned earlier, I really liked that tag team match with Davey and Super Dragon against Roderick Strong and Jack Evans. I remember Shima having some really good matches in a Battle of Los Angeles tournament one year. I really liked some of Chris Hero's stuff. A number of years later, I thought Chris Hero did some of his very best stuff in PWG, and there were some real highlights there. The thing is, like, I was going to shows so frequently, and the shows were so consistently high that the high points wouldn't stand out as much because the level of quality was consistently so high. So there aren't sort of individual memories that gravitate as much as sort of the overall quality of the shows. But yeah, those are some things that that come to mind off the top of my head. And I'm sure I'm missing a lot of really good stuff that if someone else brought up would immediately jump to mind as well.
We go to Martin from London who says, although modern-day PWG is incredible right now, going back to 2006 for this review is a great way to see what some of today's TV and developmental stars were like back then. Davey Richards was just starting out, and El Generico was barely a year into wrestling outside of Montreal, so the development they've shown in that time has been outstanding, and PWG provided a large platform for that growth.
All right, next up is Mark. As an indie promoter slash booker, shilling here for C4 Wrestling in Ottawa, the only thing I wanted to say was for listeners of the podcast that think PWG sounds interesting and never taken the chance on indies is to go out there and do it. While you might not be able to get to California for PWG, chances are there's a decent show to check out within a several-hour drive from your home. While indie wrestling can be very, very bad, there are also PWG-like shows out there that strive for high-quality products, and they can be... This is like a public service announcement here. I feel I should see it to the end. In Ontario, you have places like C4, Smash, and Alpha 1. Quebec has Battle War and NSPW. And then in the Northeast U.S., you have Evolve, Dragon Gate, Beyond Wrestling, CZW, Chikara, many others. Ohio, you have AIW. Chicago has AAW. And ACW in Austin, Texas. Go check out indie wrestling. Well, thank you, Mark. That's very, very noteworthy. Go out, spend some money. You know, while it's kind of in vogue right now, Todd, what are your thoughts on Chikara? Do you get to watch a lot?
I don't watch a lot of Chikara. I've watched a few shows over the years. I actually was listening to Quackenbush on a podcast the other week with Brian Alvarez on WrestlingObserver.com, and he described wrestling as essentially flavors of ice cream, and people have different tastes in ice cream, and they're looking for different things out of their wrestling. And the short answer is I think we like different flavors of ice cream. I've always been more drawn towards sort of physicality, towards a more serious product. And Chikara is sort of very far into the comedy aspect. And Chikara hasn't appealed to me as much as some other promotions because, you know, it's just a different taste thing. So, yeah, that's ultimately sort of my feelings on Chikara. I don't knock it, but I, you know, as someone that is often turned off by the sort of overly goofy mainstream wrestling. In independent wrestling, I do prefer a little bit more of a serious product than sort of an over-the-top comic booky thing. And one other thought on the point of independent wrestling, I would very much echo what he was saying. Obviously, he's speaking from a self-interested standpoint as being a promoter. But I think it's true that, you know, over the years, like, I think decades ago, when you were talking about small-time wrestling promoters, and maybe I'm wrong on this, but my impression was always that, you know, it was a con business. It was people looking to, you know, make money off of people in, you know, this sort of pseudo-sport world. And now, you know, with the business being so clear as to what it is, my impression with most of the wrestling promoters that have come along is they're doing it primarily because they just want to put on entertaining shows and have people enjoy it. I don't think that there isn't a lot of money on independent wrestling, and I don't think there are a lot of people looking to get rich doing it. And a lot of, you've still got your comment out there, but I think, you know, most people doing that are motivated more by the desire to entertain people and put on good shows. And there's a lot of good shows out there to check out on, you know, various levels.
Finally, we have Patrick from Ireland who says, at last, a PWG review from you guys. Decent first show to review. Really enjoyed the Richards Dragon versus Lost slash Bosch match, although it could have been 10 minutes shorter, in my opinion. Crazy seeing Brian and Claudio in front of 400 people when last week both men wrestled on SmackDown and are both featured prominently in the upcoming Elimination Chamber match. I quite enjoyed the show and this year for PWG, although nothing compares to 2011, which was the best year in their history, in my opinion. For a future review, I recommend PWG Fear.
All right. Well, thanks, everyone, for your feedback on the Law message board. And let's not forget, everybody, that on this show, there was one man on this show that did make it into the main event of WrestleMania, and that being referee Marty Elias, who was all over here, and then gets to referee Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker at one point. So that will wrap things up for this week. Todd, I want to thank you very, very much for joining us. This was a ton of fun, and I would love to have you back on if we do, whether it be a PWG or just some other review. This was a lot of fun, and you giving us the shot in the ass here. That sounds wrong, but pushing us in the direction of Pro Wrestling Guerrilla.
Well, I used earlier pat on the ass. I don't think that was any better. I at the point I said that out of my mouth, I didn't know what to say, so I just, you know, tried to continue on.
Well, I think I topped it.
Yes, one up each other, so to speak. Yeah, it's been a blast. Enjoyed chatting with you guys. We'll be in touch, and hope you guys, you know, regardless of whether it's with me, I hope you guys do some more PWG, show some love to what's been a great promotion.
And you know, I do encourage people. Me and Wei, we bought this just like Todd off of High Spots. And Todd, I'm sure you were like me, who I remember having to go to the bank and get a money order to send off to High Spots, and like you would wait 4 weeks, and I would like time it to the day of when I would be getting like the J Cup or something. And if that package didn't arrive, man, did that just ruin my night. And now you can literally, like, I was downloading this in seconds and spending $8 to get it. I think that, yeah, it's never been easier to get wrestling, but there's part of me that also misses that waiting period of having to send away for something to get it in the mail.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I remember, you know, picking up the phone or you know, at the beginning, having my dad pick up the phone and having the money for him so he could go call up and order some shows from RF Video, and I'd have to wait, you know, 4 to 6 weeks to watch, you know, some ECW, you know, random shows from 1994. And when it came in the mail, it was, you know, it was such a treat. And you don't have that sort of, you know, that anticipation building it up. But, man, it's nice to be able to access a lot of great stuff in whatever field that you're interested in a quick order and for not too much money.
Well, as we wrap things up here, everybody, for next week's review, I'm going to let Wei, because Wei's been kind of down on pro wrestling the last couple of weeks. I can see it's wearing on him. So, Wei, I'm going to give you a couple of days, and you can let us know later in the week what you would like to review next week. You pick something.
Well, you don't have to cater to me.
Well, I'm going to give you till we review Impact on Thursday night. You pick whatever you want that's going to put a smile on Wei Ting's face, and we'll let everyone know Thursday night what we're reviewing next week. And you can catch all of our shows up at liveaudiowrestling.com. For more with Todd, he does a show every Thursday with Brian Alvarez at wrestlingobserver.com. Also writes for SureDog.com, the LA Times blog. Are you going to be out at any events in the near future, Todd?
Not that I can think of. I'll be at the UFC show in Baltimore in a couple months, but nothing until then, I don't think.
All right. Well, go follow him at Todd Martin MMA. You can go follow us at Wei0937, at I am John Pollock. And Todd, is there a song that we can end the show off with? It would only be appropriate that you end things off here with some musical taste here for our listeners.
Oh, well, I'd suggested something for the beginning. Are you looking for something else in addition?
Yes, in addition. This can be anything, just to cap off the show, whether it ties in or not.
Oh, geez, you put me on the spot. is there going to be a way to edit, add something? What would be a good song to go out with?
Do you have your iPod handy? Why don't you just hit shuffle?
That's exactly what I'm doing as I'm talking here. I'm looking through my my iTunes listings here.
Just shuffle. First thing that comes up, it'll be a little key into the head of Todd Martin.
Oh, I got a good one. Why not from the Black Star album? Why don't we go with Respiration?
Respiration. All right, here we go. Todd Martin's choosing here. Thanks again, Todd, and we will chat with you all later on this week.
The new moon rode high in the crown of the metropolis, shining like who on top of this? People were sussling, arguing and bustling. Gangsters are God from hardcore hustling. I'm wrestling with words and ideas. My ears is pricked, seeking what will transmit. Scribes can apply to transcript. Yo, this ain't no time where the usual or the suitable. Tonight alive, let's describe the inscrutable, the indisputable. We New York, the narcotics, draped in metal and fiber optics. We're mercenaries. Is paid to trade hot stocks for profits.
filthy criminals dig pockets. Hard knuckles on the second hands of working class watches. Skyscrapers is colossus. The cost of living is preposterous. Stay alive, you pay or die, no options. No Batman and Robin. Can't tell between the cops and the robbers. They both partners, they all heartless with no conscience. Back streets stay darkened, while unbeliever hearts stay hardened. My ego talent stay sharpened, like city lights stay throbbing. You either make a way or stay sobbing. The shiny apple is bruised but sweet, and if you choose to eat, you could lose your teeth. Many crews retreat, nightly news repeat. Who got shot down the lockdown? Spotlight the savages, NASDAQ averages. My narrative grows to explain its existence amidst the harbor lights which remain in the distance. So much on my mind that I can't recline. Blast the holes in the night till she blends sunshine. Breathe in, inhale vapors from bright stars to shine. Breathe out. Smoke, retrace the skyline. Heard the bass ride out like an ancient maiden call. I can't take it, y'all. I can feel the city breathing, chest heaving against the flesh of the evening. Sigh before it died like the last train leaving.
Breathing in deep city breaths, sitting on leadership steps. We stooped to new lows. Hell froze the night the city slept. The beast crept through concrete jungles, communicating with one another. And ghetto birds reward us for from the hydrants to the gutters. The beast walked the beats, but the beats we be making. You on the wrong side of the track, looking visibly shaken, taking in plungers. Plunging to death that's painted by the numbers will crawl under plow pressure. Cats is playing God but having children by a lesser baby mother. But fuck it, we played against each other like puppets. Swearing you got pool when the only pool you got is the wool over your eyes. Getting knowledge in jail like a blessing in disguise. Look in the skies for God, what you see besides the smog is broken dreams flying away in the wings of the obscene. Thoughts that people put in the air, places where you could get murdered over a glare. But everything is fair, it's a paradox we call reality. So keeping it real will make you a casualty of abnormal normality. Killers born naturally like Mickey and Mallory. Not knowing the ways will get you capped like an NBA salary.
So much on my mind, I just can't recline. Blast the holes in the night till she blends sunshine. Breathe in, inhale vapors from bright stars to shine. Breathe out. Green smoke retrace the skyline. Yo, dump the bass ride out like an ancient mating call. I can't take it, y'all. I can feel the city breathing, chest heaving against the flesh of the evening. Sigh before it died like the last train leaving.